The Burt Cohen Show, Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
It's The Burt Cohen Show. Happening to the dream? Do we have a democratic process going on? Who is determining our country's economic fate? Our taxes, our programs like Social Security and Medicare, is it in the hands of elected officials? Or what the heck is this super committee that is bumping up against a tight deadline? Has Congress just kicked the can down the road trying to avoid responsibility? Or may something good come of it in the face of this so-called debt crisis? Well, our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is R.J. Eskow, columnist for Huffington Post. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And he is a columnist for the Huffington Post and was a public policy and finance economics consultant in the U.S. and over 20 countries. His past clients have included USAID, the World Bank, State Department, Harvard School of International Public Health, the Government of Hungary, as well as corporations and investors. His personal blog is A Nightlight. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Richard. What is the super committee? What is its tasks? Its task, and, well, let's just start with that. What is a super committee? What's it supposed to do?
The super committee was created by a special act of Congress. It contains six members of the House of Representatives, six senators, and it's half Republicans, half Democrats, and they've been charged with coming up with a fixed amount of savings in reductions in the deficit over the next 10 years to add on to those that have already been agreed to. So their mission, basically, it's designed this way. They are appointed by the leadership of their parties. They go off, they cut their deal in private with nobody hearing their negotiations. They come back with a proposal that is presented to both houses, and in particular, in violation of Senate rules, has to be voted completely up or completely down with no debate, no amendments. I mean, there can be debate, but no amendments, no changes, none of the usual procedural rules. If you've been following the Senate at all, you know that nowadays you need 60 votes just to get something passed, because otherwise they'll filibuster it. That can't happen with this. They've really just paved the way for whatever they recommend to have a very high likelihood of getting passed.
Wow. So it sounds kind of anti-democratic, actually. They can't really discuss it. They just kick the can to some, as they say, a super committee. I don't know why the image that comes to my mind is something like they used to have in the Soviet Union, where these unelected committees would do it in secret, and who knows what the influences may be on the policy that comes up, and it affects an awful lot of people. So how much is the super committee supposed to cut? We hear talks of $1.5 trillion or something like that. Is that the amount that they're supposed to cut?
Yes, it's in the it's in that neighborhood, and they are now. Here's what's happening: is first of all, theoretically, and the Democrats on the committee will keep telling you this, but theoretically, they're supposed to cut the deficit so they could do it all, for example, with tax increases on millionaires. They're not going to, but Theoretically, they could. So they have these targets of reducing the deficit, which the Democrats are anxious to beat, and we'll get to that in a second. But basically, yes, they have these trillion-dollar targets, multi-trillion-dollar targets. They are you have to take a step back at this whole process, I think, and say, how did this come to be? Why is it then when we have wage stagnation for the middle class, who have barely budgeted all in 50 years in terms of, in certain ways, have lost ground in their earnings in 50 years. We have explosive growth of income on the top 1% and especially on the top 0.1% and so on. Why, when we have 25 million Americans unemployed or underemployed, why is it that we are talking now about reducing the deficit? It's kind of like saying, to a sick patient, we're spending too much on your medications before the patient gets well. So, sure, you need to worry about, you know, the cost of medications, but first you get the patient well. So, so there's a whole history behind that, why it is that they've been charged with this, and then there's a whole history about their process and why it is, for example, that they've heard from all sorts of people who are on record as wanting to cut Social Security and Medicare and government spending of all kinds and even lower taxes more for the wealthy, but they have yet to hear, for example, from people who are on Social Security or people who need Medicare. So, you know, it's an extremely skewed process, done completely in secret, and very, very disturbing. And the role of the Democrats in particular has been extremely disappointing. They have already gone on record as saying they want to beat their goal and come up with all sorts of additional money. But they're also on record saying that they'd be willing to make cuts to Social Security. So we've got a situation where nobody is really defending. And then now bear in mind that most Republicans, much less most Democrats and independents, don't want cuts to Social Security. According to one poll, 76% of Tea Party rally attendees don't want Social Security cut to balance the deficit. Yet here you have a group of Democrats proposing to do exactly that as their opening proposal to the Republicans, who will propose even more. So that's how distorted this whole picture has gotten.
And this committee, Richard, it meets in secret, but who has access to them, and what is the process for deciding which interests have access and can testify before this committee?
Well, they decide who they want to hear from.
Oh,
so,
my.
For example, they have heard from Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles.
Wow.
Alan Simpson, you know, the president's supposedly bipartisan commission on cutting the deficit. Now, bear in mind, Social Security doesn't affect the deficit. It's not allowed to by law. But these two guys were determined to cut Social Security. Simpson is the Republican with all sorts of behavioral problems and manners problems and a very, very angry, bitter man who bursts into explosions of rage. They're on the internet if he's asked simple questions about the policies he's proposing. And Erskine Bowles, who worked for the Clinton administration, is on the board of directors of Morgan Stanley, the bailed out financial firm. So that's supposedly your balanced viewpoint. They were brought in to present their recommendations on cutting Social Security and so on. And yet other groups, for example, a group I'm affiliated with, Social Security Works, which includes experts in the field, people who are on the commission that Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to adjust Social Security when it really needed adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
These people have been trying to get before the super committee, and they won't have them. And, you know, disabled people who depend on Social Security to survive, or the parents of disabled children, they can't get an appointment to speak before the committee. But Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles can get an appointment.
Well, the Simpson-Bowles Commission was appointed by President Obama to, it sounds like they had basically the same mission as the super committee. Is that not the case? And what is a bit of the genesis of Simpson-Bowles leading to the super committee?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's very, very clear. Look, there's been a playbook. There's a guy named Pete Peterson, who's a billionaire, who's been trying to cut Social Security and Medicare for 20-something years. He was in the Nixon administration. I think he was Secretary of Commerce. He has been working on this a long, long time. He's created foundations and trusts and done deals with Democrats and Republicans, and they've got their playbook, and they've been trying to run it over and over again. Nearly 2 years ago, a very senior administration official said to me and a couple, several other people in a very small group off the record, so I can't name the person, said, in effect, the Simpson and Bowles commission is going to come up with a plan. It's going to include cuts to Social Security. This will reassure the bond markets and so on, even though there's no evidence that that's even needed. And it will look bipartisan, and that will give us cover, and we're going to do it that way. And my question was, well, what if the committee, the commission deadlocks? And that person said, well, then the two heads of the commission, Simpson and Bowles, will write their own report and will use that. Now, remember, the commission itself, this super committee is an echo of the Simpson-Bowles commission. The way that was set up, also, Congress had to vote straight up or down vote, no amendments, and so on. So they have this playbook, make it look bipartisan, do this thing that most people don't want, and don't allow amendments or changes. So that was the plan with the deficit commission. It derailed because the public was outraged, and really the White House and everyone else was indicted, inundated with calls. So that failed. So now they've got the super committee, and all of a sudden they're running the same playbook again. Bipartisan cover, secret meetings, and now you have to give it this straight up or down vote. They are determined they will come back over and over. They're like the Terminator about this thing, trying to terminate Social Security. They will come back over and over again using the same methods to try to eliminate it, and that's what we're seeing now.
We're talking to R.J. Esko about the super committee, and as you said, getting back a little bit, that Social Security is not in the budget directly, and yet they're looking for 1.4, 1.5 trillion, which I understand it's a little bit impossible to get one's hands around what a trillion is. I believe it's 1,000 billion. 1,000 billion, which, and so numbers are just unbelievable. So how can they focus so laser-like on cutting Social Security and Medicare if that's not going to help bring them to 1.5 trillion? Or are they just, you know, playing with numbers here, as certainly has happened before?
You know, in certain ways, it's baffling. In certain ways, you know, you start to wonder what part of this is deal-making, what part of this is a kind of sociology or anthropology problem, because you talk to these guys, and so many of them, Democrats as well as Republicans, really believe this stuff, and it's like trying to talk to, you know, a cult person who comes to your door, trying to recruit you into that. You know, you're not going to change their mind because there's been so much work done on basically brainwashing people about this stuff. So it's hard to know how much is deal-making and how much is brainwashing, but, you know, Social Security, the way Social Security works, it's people pay into it. You know, everybody with a job pays with a few exceptions, government workers and so on, pays into a payroll tax. Everybody sees it, the FICA tax. That big chunk of that goes to Social Security. Their employers match it. That has been a separate trust fund, and the reason why FDR, Roosevelt, set it up the way he did was he said so that no damn politician can get their hands on it in the future. But he underestimated the determination of this group. But now what they've done, they figured this, the safest way to invest your money and my money, which is what that money is, is with special treasury bonds, bonds from the Department of the Treasury. So the Social Security has 2.6 $1 trillion saved up. You know, you got all this misinformation and propaganda. Oh, all the baby boomers are going to retire and we can't afford that. No, there's $2.6 trillion saved up because back under Reagan and Tip O'Neill, they knew, you know, it's not a surprise that a lot of people were born before 1961. We've known it since 1961. So basically that's what they adjusted for. Now, there are some long-term adjustments that need to be made, but every recommendation these guys come up with seems to be much worse than that. Why? You know, we could speculate endlessly, but it's probably a combination of groupthink, brainwashing, deal cutting, and, you know, all the other things that people do inside the Beltway in Washington.
Now, their deadline, the supercommittee's deadline, is November 23rd, which is fast approaching. Okay, what happens if it doesn't meet its deadline?
Well, they'll probably vote themselves an extension, I would guess. I mean, look, you know, everybody wants them to do this, everybody in Washington, everybody outside.
Rather than doing it themselves, yeah.
Right. Everybody outside the Beltway doesn't want them to, but everybody inside the Beltway does want them to. My suspicion, if they need an extension, they'll get an extension. But if they don't, then supposedly what's going to happen is all these automatic triggers will take place, these triggered cuts, and, you know, everybody's waving their hands in the air about that. And, you know, there are concerns with that. But bear in mind, there's nothing that says that these triggers have to be fired and these cuts have to be made. Congress enacted them. Congress can retract them. So what they've been trying to do, this is another something that I guess they thought up in a think tank bull session or something, is this idea of we're going to vote triggers that kind of, they're like, you know, IEDs in Iraq or something. They blow themselves up, but we didn't do it. They just, the trigger went off so that they can escape responsibility. But, you know, so if you don't do X by this period, then the trigger goes off and all of a sudden everything gets cut. Well, no, it's still you doing that. And even if a different Congress and a different president take office, you can undo it. You don't, you know, no Congress can bind future Congresses, no president can bind future presidents. So if you don't like the triggered cuts, you don't have to do them. So, this is all an exercise in politicians trying to do something that's unnecessary and politically unpopular, but giving themselves cover so that they can say, one, I had no other choice, and B, aren't I wonderful? Aren't I a good boy or a good girl because I made a grand bargain? And so this is all very carefully thought out to give them protection, but there are those of us who are determined that they won't get that cover. They're going to take responsibility for their actions.
Well, how can that be? I'm very curious to follow up on that. How can, you know, it seems to be an exercise in the good old political tradition of CYA, cover your butt, but how, what can be done? I mean, it strikes me, correct me if I'm wrong, that the very existence, the creation of this super committee just demonstrates a failure of Washington to function. And that leads to groups, unfortunate groups like No Labels, calling for an end to partisan bickering, saying, oh, just be nice to one another. And what it really is calling on Democrats to just lay down and let the right wing walk all over them. And, you know, they're trying to look really bipartisan. And, you know, Democrats are falling into a trap of, rubber stamping the veracity of the whole debt crisis premise. And I wonder about this whole debt crisis premise that was whipped up by Republicans a few months ago, creating this insistence on the necessity of deficit reduction in the face of our big debt. And I wonder, and it just strikes me that something's going on here that isn't really clear, that there's some sort of purposeful diversion away from the real issues like jobs, and that this is some kind of way for the Democrats specifically to just cover their own butts. But you have said, and I think this is an interesting quote, and I'll have to change it a little bit for radio, the party of the donkey is about to give itself a real butt kicking. Could you explain that, please?
Well, the word I used is just another word for donkey.
Well, that's true.
The donkey is kicking itself. Yeah, absolutely, because, look, these are extremely unpopular positions. I mean, there are a couple things here. One is when you hear the word, don't get me started on no labels, because I come from New York City, where if someone tries to sell you clothing with no labels, it's counterfeit. But bipartisan, here's what's bipartisan outside Washington. Most Republicans, most Democrats, most independents believe that jobs is our number one priority,
right.
Believes we've got to do more to regulate and tax Wall Street, believes we should tax millionaires, believes we should protect Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
That's true bipartisan consensus throughout the country. Whenever anyone in Washington uses the word bipartisan, they mean a few wealthy elite Democrats and a few wealthy elite Republicans got together with wealthy elite people like Pete Peterson and cut a deal. So check your watch and wallet every time you hear the word bipartisan coming from someone in Washington, because it doesn't mean what the rest of us mean. In terms of the party of the donkey kicking its own donkiness, look, you know, this is the Democratic members of the Supercommittee have already put forward their proposal to cut Social Security, and somehow they think that perhaps that this is a grand strategy, the Republicans will reject it, and then they'll look, hey, weren't we reasonable? But now they're on record as cutting Social Security. That's not good. You know, they, one of the reasons they got their donkey kicked in 2010 in Congress was because of all things, which is absurd when you know the details, the Republicans successfully ran as the party that's defending Medicare from the Democrats.
Hmm.
Now, here the Democrats, having learned nothing, are out there saying, we'll cut your Social Security, we'll decrease your cost of living adjustments and all that, but it's because we're such reasonable people, and most Republicans don't want that. So first of all, it looks bad. Secondly, wait till 2012 and see how many Republicans go out there and say, you know, these guys wanted to cut your Social Security and Medicare, and we're the guys protecting you. Well, gee, I don't think that's going to work out well for them.
Yeah, it does seem to me that if Democrats go happily along with cutting Social Security and Medicare and raise taxes on all but the richest, the message that that gives to middle-class Americans who voted for Obama is like, okay, there's no point in voting Democrat. But these Democrats have to be thinking about their own reelection. I mean, that's their raison d'etre to keep getting reelected. So,
well, sure, but last time I was in Washington, I went to a meeting with some progressive members of Congress, and just an informal thing off the record, but I'll tell you, these people were very, very depressed, and I don't blame them. They're in a horrible spot right now for first of all, because they feel about it the way that I and undoubtedly you do, but also because they know what it's doing to their careers. I mean, you know, the way that the Democrats appear to be endorsing a Social Security cut is by lowering the calculation of changes in the cost of living index. And it gets a little kind of wonky or technical sounding, but basically the deal is this. The formula that's used, you know, when you're on Social Security, you're disabled or you're retired or whatever, every year there's a calculation performed on how the cost of living is increased, and your benefit is adjusted accordingly.
Right.
Now, what the Democrats have signed on to is lowering that calculation. And you'll hear even President Obama has said this, well, it's a technical adjustment to make it more correct. That's the opposite of the truth. What it really, even now, for seniors and the disabled, that adjustment is too low, because the adjustment in the cost of living for everybody, the whole population, isn't weighted for the expenses that those populations have. For example, they use public transportation more and they use medical care more. Those things are going up in cost more than everything else on average. So they're already getting shortchanged, seniors and the disabled. Now they want to cut that even more to a calculation that's outrageous in the way it works, because it would stiff all of us, because they're basically saying, if you can't afford to, you know, the way the calculation works now, if the price of beef goes up 10%, that's a 10% adjustment. Right now, what they would say is, if the price of beef goes up 10% and you can't afford it and you start eating dog food, well, then we're going to calculate how much you spend on dog food. So they call that the chain CPI. They're signing on to that, which not only cuts Social Security benefits, but it would also be the logic used to adjust the tax brackets for people who aren't already in the top tax bracket. Now, if you do that, that starts to throw off all those calculations too. So we've really got a lot of monkeying going around here that we'd be better off staying away from. And they're not being very wise about that. So they really, really are getting into some dangerous territory here.
We are talking with R.J. Eskow, columnist for Huffington Post and public policy, finance, economics consultant for a whole bunch of powerful, important groups, about the super committee on the Burt Cohen Show. It seems like the reason there is this super committee is because they want to, you know, kick the can down the road. These guys, the elected members of Congress, don't want to be the ones saying, you know, yes, I cut your Social Security. But don't they have to do the unpopular thing? Don't we need to? I mean, don't polls show a lot of Americans want to cut the deficit? Isn't it important to voters? Isn't it important to our economy? Doesn't the super committee have a role to play in doing the unpopular thing?
Well, you know, 2 points there. One is, you know, do we need to cut the deficit? And two is what the polls show. In terms of number one, yes, eventually, of course, we do. I mean, it's something that anybody, you know, in the long term should be concerned about. But first of all, you don't cut the deficit by leaving a lot of people unemployed. You know, when you have enormous amounts of unemployment and underemployment, wage stagnation, a person without a job isn't paying taxes. If they're not paying taxes, then that money isn't, the money they're not paying,
right,
isn't reducing the deficit. So you lose all that revenue because you have all these unemployed people. Same thing with underemployed people. If a person is making $100 instead of $200, you're losing $100, you know, the tax income on the second $100. So you want to revitalize the economy and get people back to work, create jobs, get that growth cycle going again, and then you've got all this additional revenue flowing into the government, which cuts the deficit. You get a reduction in poverty, so the government isn't spending on anti-poverty, which cuts the deficit, and on and on. Less food stamps and so on, less assistance and so on, all the way down the line. So that's number one. That's how you, so it, just as in business, sometimes you have to invest to grow. So
yes.
Number one, you invest, then you grow, and you cut the deficit. Now, if you look out 50 years in the deficit, first of all, I should go back a second. Where did the deficit come from? Today, remember, when George Bush took office, we had a surplus.
Yes, indeed.
Where did the deficit come from? It came from two unnecessary wars and enormous tax cuts, especially to the rich who didn't need it, who were already doing great. So you get rid of that tax cut, you get the revenue, especially for the wealthy. I wouldn't say tax the middle class, especially now, but
right,
you get rid of that tax cut for the wealthy, and you give a millionaire's tax. So you fix it on the revenue side. Going out 50 years, what's the big problem? Healthcare expenses, Medicare, and so on. Why is it a big problem? Because we are the only developed country in the world that relies on private health insurers, and that has caused, you know, the way doctors make money gives them bad incentives, the way health insurers makes money gives them bad incentives. So all the way up and down the chain, we've got a broken system. You're really worried about the deficit 40 years from now? Fix the health care system, but of course that means going to more of a public health care, Medicare for all type model. So that's what we should be looking at.
Interesting. You know, people had thought the conventional wisdom these days seems to have been, oh, Obama made a big mistake in focusing on adjusting health care and improving the health care system, and, you know, should have just been focused on jobs. But as you're saying, if you look at what are the causes of the deficit in the long term, bingo, the health care problem, keeping it in private hands. Very, very interesting. People don't really focus on that. But if we're talking about, you know, the deficit, okay, the Simpson Bowles, others are just focusing laser-like on all New Deal programs. But there got to be other places to cut besides Social Security and Medicare. And should we expect and assume that these guys, the super committee behind closed doors, is looking at cuts across the board, and that everything is in fact on the table? I mean, what about gifts to oil corporations, to the energy corporations, subsidies to nuclear power, subsidies to agribusiness, things like that? Isn't it their responsibility to look at these things? Surely they must. They can't not look at these things, could they?
Well, they can do whatever they want, and knowing that we'll never know what they did or didn't do. I mean, of course, they should look at all of those things, but they're in a situation where each of the parties can say to the other, especially the Democrats, look, I had to do it, and this is what I had to do. Well, actually, you don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what you should do, a well-run Democratic Party that really represented, you know, the middle class would do the following. It would say everything should be public. You know, all these deals they cut in private, the way they cut the health care bill deals in private, the way they cut the financial reform deals in private, undermines, subverts democracy. And when Christopher Dodd, a Democrat, gets together with Senator Richard Shelby, a Republican, and cuts all sorts of necessary financial reforms away, like breaking up the too big to fail banks, reinstalling the Glass-Steagall Act, and protecting our investments and so on, when they get to, and then Shelby doesn't vote for it anyway, that's perverting democracy. So, you know, and so is the super committee. What they should really do is say $40 billion a year for oil company subsidies. We're going to vote for that on the floor of the Senate. We're going to vote for it on the floor of the House and let the public decide who they support. Because you know what happens, interestingly enough, those provisions of the financial reform bill that got debated in public, even some of what you'd call the more progressive positions, you had Republicans crossing the aisle to join Democrats like Senator Grassley and Senator Coburn, because they were not going to be seen in public standing up for these things. When you let these things be done in private, you let these unpopular, unethical deals continue.
So I'm my mind goes back to Occupy Wall Street people who are saying, hey, wait a minute here. And they are saying something very clear, which is fairly simple, that there's not a level playing field, that this government is owned lock, stock, and barrel, to use a way old cliche, by the banks, the financial interests on Wall Street. They're not playing on a level playing field, and that the field should be leveled, and that there should be, in fact, regulations, that instead of being too big to fail, as somebody said, they're too big to exist. I'm guessing that was Barney Frank. But how much, I mean, do they really, these banks, these financial houses, they must have, I'm guessing they have access to the super committee. They have tremendous power over Congress. And yet, all the polls show, as you said, even some Republicans, they don't want to be seen as protecting the assets of these big, you know, greedy financial houses that are paying outrageous bonuses. Do they?
Well, no, but first of all, yes, millions have been spent lobbying the super committee. Yes, they have access to all these people, everyone up and down the political system. And yes, Occupy Wall Street is shining a light on all of this stuff. You know, when you and I talked last, I think it was 4th of July, and I'd written that piece, you know, declaring independence from corporate politics. And we talked about that, and, you know, my dream was, my pipe dream was that, you know, people would start saying, we cannot depend on an institutionally elected politician in this country or political party to bring along real change. Now, we can vote for candidates of Party A or Party B, but the real change has got to come from outside this political system, which is totally polluted and corrupted by corporate and Wall Street money, and along comes Occupy Wall Street, you know, the American autumn, you know, after the Arab Spring. So, yes, I would say they're absolutely putting them in a very uncomfortable position, but look, these guys are going to try to play it both ways as absolutely long as they can. You've got the administration, you've got David Plouffe now, campaign manager for the president, saying we're going to use the rage at Wall Street, you know, to fuel our campaign, at the same time that they're busy trying to force the attorneys general of 50 states to accept a deal that is cushy for the banks and protects the banks from the consequences of widespread crime and fraud around mortgages and foreclosures. So, you know, the job of any independent movement is going to be, you want a piece of this, you know, you want a piece of the emotion we're channeling. You got to walk the walk as well as talk the talk, and that means no settlement, no cushy settlement deals with the banks, no more having it both ways, no super committee. That's what people have got to be relentless about.
Is it possible, Richard, that the people on the super committee will introduce legislation, will call for legislation to exempt the Pentagon from cuts? I mean, there has been this unbelievable military welfare. You talk about serious dollars. And if the Republicans call for exempting the Pentagon from cuts and trying to adjust the deficit, I wonder how possible it is that Democrats might be willing to hold the line and risk that silly accusation of being soft on defense. What do you see happening there? I mean, the public, I think, wants to see this huge, unbelievable waste in the Pentagon. We're paying to maintain and build new Cold War-oriented weapon systems to the tune of, like, tens of, if not hundreds of billions of dollars a year.
Well, and our national security apparatus, which is enormous and invisible and expending insane sums of money, and these private contract armies we hire now, and on and on and on. No, absolutely. I mean, I think the likelihood of the Democrats being more aggressive on that is small. My guess would be that the committee would come back with some token cuts to the military that both Democrats and Republicans agree on. I mean, Secretary of Defense Gates, who was a holdover from the previous Republican administration,
right,
already proposed some modest cuts. They'll do something along those lines, I would guess, and say, see, we cut the military too. But that won't stop them from demanding these other cuts. Also, you're hearing talk now that the Republicans might accept some form of revenue enhancement. Now, the other thing that observers should know is that I always get nervous when I hear the phrase revenue enhancement instead of tax increases, because then what they're talking about could very well be what Simpson and Bowles were talking about, which is to lower the top tax rate even more, but start hacking away at some of those deductions that, you know, are keeping some of the middle class afloat, like, you know, home mortgage interest or employer health care deductions and so on. So I get nervous. We'll see about that. But in terms of defense, my guess is something symbolic, and that's it. You know, you really want to save some money in this country, get out of Afghanistan, get out of Iraq, close these bases around, you know, how many countries now, 100 countries, 75 countries, stop these high-tech weapons that will never work, that we have no need for, and concentrate. We spend more now than we did at the height of the Cold War, and we have no Soviet Union. You know, we have nobody pointing 25,000 missiles at us. So they're still out there, which is scary, but we don't have the same Cold War threat. We're spending way more. The way to stop, they're trying to use Islamic terrorism as the new Soviet Union.
Yes.
But John Kerry was absolutely right in 2004 when he said that's a policing problem. That's a law enforcement problem. So, you know, really, yeah, you want to cut that you want to cut the deficit, you want to cut spending, that's where you should go, and they will never do it.
And that brings us back to the question of democracy. Here we have a super committee that's unanswerable. I mean, I don't know to whom it's accountable, really. Maybe it's not accountable. And the public, Democrat, Republican, are largely agreeing with what, for example, Ron Paul is talking about. As you say, you know, stop, you know, pouring these billions and billions of dollars down the rat hole that gets us nothing of all these bases all over the world, buying these, you know, ridiculous weapon systems that don't do anything except give profits to certain special military contractors. So here's, on one side is public opinion, which is solidly not just, you know, your typical lefty peacenicks, but conservative Republicans in the true sense of the word conservative, who are saying, I mean, maybe they're being accused of being isolationist, I suppose, but this is the will of the people to get, you know, to stop this wasteful spending and to get back to thinking of national security in terms of national security, you know, actual economic strength here and actually building our, you know, our actual security. So how can it be that not only Republicans, but Democrats, too, are willing to look at cutting things that are popular like Social Security and Medicare? And they, even though the public wants cuts for the Pentagon, can they be that brazen, that, you know, blatantly in the pockets of the defense contractors to just thumb their nose at the public and say, we're not listening, we don't care? Are they not worried about taking that stance? And is the super committee just playing into that whole dynamic?
Well, yes, they are absolutely, whether it's, you know, yes, I think it's all of the above. Some of it is deals with defense contractors in some cases, and others it may just be fear of being accused of being weak,
right,
on defense.
Right.
Whatever it is, look, you know, to me, like I say, it's partially a corruption problem and partially an anthropology problem of, you know, the kind of collective wisdom that these people all share. And until there are consequences for their actions, it's not going to change. You know, I mean, you know, I have this running battle with centrist Democratic groups who say, you know, guys like me are progressives living in the old 70s or 60s political paradigm of left versus right. And my response to that is, no, look at the polls, man. The polls say, I'm the centrist, you're the radical, and I say, you're living in an old paradigm. You're living in a paradigm of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when you had to cut deals with defense contractors, you had to worry about being called soft on defense, you had to, you know, the Clinton era is dead. It's over. Bill, I hate to break this to people, you know, a lot of people I like, but the Bill Clinton era of Democratic centrism was fueled on an economic bubble and was based, it was a different world then. So anyone who thinks you can play the centrist game, triangulating to the right, trying to be the Democratic Party as slicker, smoother, friendlier Republicans, is in for a shock of their life. They got it in 2010. They didn't get the message. They may get it again in 2012 because they're living in that old, we can be Bill Clinton, we can be slicker and smoother about, you know, being pro-business. It doesn't work anymore. The banks crashed the economy. Everybody knows it. You can't play that game. You can't be Wall Street Democrats anymore and expect that everybody will play along now, because a lot of Occupy Wall Street won't. A lot of other people won't. Young people who gave Democrats the presidency and the House and the Senate in 2008, stayed home in 2010 more than they did in 2006. So, you know, it's not guys like me that are going to decide the outcome of the 2012 election. It's people like them. And if they keep playing this triangulating game, I have very pessimistic feelings about their chances.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with R.J. Eskow, columnist for Huffington Post, public policy and finance and economics consultant for the U.S. and USAID, World Bank, State Department, etc. His personal blog is A Nightlight it amazes me how, just on a pragmatic sense, that the Democrats don't get it, that cautious positioning alienates, and being brave and taking passionate positions attracts and works. And they're about getting reelected, and you're right, they got their butts handed to them in 2010, and maybe doing it again. And again, here we have people like Ron Paul, who is resonating with a lot of Republicans. It's surprising to me. At this super committee, they're talking about cut, you know, in a certain few areas. They're not, as I understand it, and we don't know what they're doing, all the backroom boys. Gosh, we thought we had done away with backroom politics a long time ago, but apparently it's back again because it's convenient. What revenue? I mean, you know, when you talk about deficits, there's spending and there's revenue. There's income and there's outflow. What revenue do you think that they may be talking about raising? Are they getting that, you know, when you have these tax cuts for the super wealthy, it, in fact, there's lots of examples, doesn't help boost the economy. You can do that and they can win. Do you have any sense from your intelligence what the super committee is doing in terms of raising revenue?
Well, no, I don't, because they're, you know, again, they're being
doors.
So secretive. But, there are rumors that some Republicans are willing to sign on to certain types of revenue increases. So all I can go by, and the visits from Simpson and Bowles and so on, is my concern that they might go toward eliminating, you know, they use the term tax expenditures to make it sound like spending, eliminate some of the deductions that, as I say, the middle class depends on. Now, you could have, if there are economists listening, you know, you could have a theoretical discussion about whether the home mortgage interest deduction is a good thing or a bad thing for the economy. Does it distort? Does it artificially inflate home prices and so on? But we're in reality, and in reality, we've got a battered and beleaguered middle class. So if they start chipping away at that, that's going to be horrendous. If they start adjusting the tax bracket so that people pop into a higher bracket sooner, that's going to be horrendous. And, of course, it's going to affect everybody except the wealthiest, who are already in a top class. So if they start doing that kind of tinkering, it would be terrible. Now, if they were to raise taxes on capital gains income, or differentiate between investment income and non-productive. I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things they could do with tax,
financial transactions,
income, and a millionaire's tax and so on. But are they going to do it? I doubt it. I wish they would, but the problem with an undemocratic black box like this kind of process is, you know, you just wait for the oracle to speak, and the oracle speaks, and then everyone's supposed to say, okay. Well, the Delphic oracle, they now say, was a mass hallucination caused by rotting grain. So, you know, that's probably a good analogy for the super committee.
The oracle, there's democracy at work, waiting for the great Oz to tell us what we need to do.
Exactly.
My goodness. So I wonder, you know, what does this mean for the Republicans? Let's look in a crystal ball, talking about oracles and magic here. Say they come out with significant cuts to Social Security and welfare, as we expect them to do, and leave things totally wonderful for the owners of this country, apparently. How does this affect the Republicans come 2012? I can't imagine this is a real popular position. Sure, they'll get a lot of campaign money. Maybe that's all they care about. But does this scenario benefit the Republicans more than Democrats? And if so, how?
Well, we can only go by past experience, and the Republicans completely outplayed the Democrats on Medicare in 2010, which was outrageous. But look, let's say, there's the presidential race and then there's others. You know, the presidential race is decided a lot more on personality. Obama's numbers are picking up now that he's using more progressive rhetoric, which is, should be a lesson to him of what we've been trying to tell him for 3 years. But, you know, and maybe even if he doesn't back that up with action, and maybe even if he does endorse a super committee, you know, decision to cut Medicare and Social Security, maybe he squeaks that through to a victory. I don't know, but or maybe not, because it's looking shaky right now. But everywhere else down the ticket, you know, my guess would be that the Republicans are smart enough to say, in effect, that the Democrats made us do it. You know, they we went into the super committee, and you know, you read their proposal where they said they were going to, they insisted on cutting Social Security and Medicare. So we said, okay, but you know, if you give us more power next time, we won't have to have a super committee. We'll defend your Medicare and Social Security. I'm almost certain that's how they're going to run it.
Well, Democrats in Washington, you know, they're not dumb. Why are they buying into this? Is it just for campaign contributions? Is it that simple?
No, again, I mean, again, I think it's partially campaign contributions. I think it's partially consensus of their peers, and those are the only voices. Look, think of it this way, for one thing. I mean, and I've thought about this a lot in terms of Obama, but every politician. A politician is a person who is hardwired to please everybody in the room.
Right.
So when you're coming up in politics, you're pleasing everybody in whatever room you start in. When you get to the top like these guys on the super committee, mostly you're in the room with Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, and all those guys. And so now you're hardwired to please them. I think that's a big part of it. I think the other contributions are a part of it. I think that you've had these think tanks now for 30 years taking corporate and billionaire funding and pumping out these insane economic ideas. I think they all buy into those. So I think there's a kind of consensus worldview there. And then I think there is, as I say, a kind of tribal anthropological situation where, especially for Democrats, you have to prove you're a real quote-unquote adult and show your bona fides by throwing grandma off the train. You know, I mean, I really think that Democrats feel, a certain kind of Democrat feels they have to prove they're serious politicians by cutting poverty programs, cutting Social Security. You know, like in the mafia, you're not a made man until you kill somebody.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think there's a kind of psychology there. So I think there are several, you know, it might make an interesting book, actually. Maybe I should propose that. But I really do think I've met these
looking
guys,
tough.
I've talked to them. Honestly, it's like talking to the people who come to your door trying to convert you. You know, with religion, and they've got, you know, and you try to say to these guys, you know, listen, but I have all this evidence that shows A, B, and C, and D, and I have these charts I want to show you in these graphs, and they come back just like the people who ring your doorbell, and they say, have you read book one of Thessalonians or whatever? You know, there's no breaking through, and so it's at the same time frustrating and kind of fascinating, but it also means the one thing that gets through to them is voters.
That,
so angry voters, angry calls from constituents, that does get through to them. You know, we can come in with graphs and charts, they couldn't care less. They've, in effect, been brainwashed. But if voters call up and say, that's why the president didn't announce proposed Social Security cuts in the State of the Union. We knew he was going to, and it was later confirmed by the Wall Street Journal and others, and the various groups like Campaign for America Future, which I work with, made sure the White House was flooded with calls, and they took it out of the speech. That's what you have to do. Calls, emails, voter dissatisfaction, those are things, perhaps the only things, that get their attention.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the members of Congress are seeing that now or hearing that now. People don't seem to be keeping those calls and letters coming in. It absolutely does work. But right now, I can just picture, you know, here's the scenario. They set up the super committee. Oh, we're bipartisan. Look at us. Aren't we good? We're bipartisan. And then the super committee comes up with its draconian recommendations that are going to hurt a lot of people. And a lot of Democrats can say, well, what could we do? What could we do? We try to do something, but darn it, you know, this is the only thing we can do. We have to cut the budget in these ways. I don't know how else it could come out aside from that, unless you hear from the people, because actually we still are a republic and still have some degree of democracy. So that can happen. Now, Barney Frank, I know, has always been there. You know, he's come out and talking about how the Republicans are for weaponized Keynesianism. You know, stimulus spending is great if it's for weapons systems.
Right.
But, and he's on the banking committee. Are there people in Congress who are coming out and saying, hey, no, super committee, this is not the way to do it. We need to actually take responsibility and be answerable to the people.
Sure, there are. I mean, I don't know that Barney Frank is, but there are people, for example, in the Progressive Caucus, which paradoxically, the Democratic Progressive Caucus, the House Progressive Caucus, is the only group I know of, the only organized group in Congress that's speaking for the majority of Republicans on some of these issues. But so those guys are, and they're certainly saying and doing all the right things. There are some members of Congress saying and doing the right things. You've got Tom Harkin now and a couple others proposing, you know, financial transactions tax, so,
yes,
and that kind of thing. So there are people, but I mean, I would think that, for example, since I imagine he's within our listening range today, that Barney Frank's constituents would be spending their time extraordinarily well by letting him know what they think about the super committee and what they think about these issues, because he's a very influential guy.
Yes.
He's not just another member of Congress. So,
sure.
And of course, Senator Kerry is on the super committee and has endorsed these, you know, god awful and self-destructive proposals. Now, I know Senator Kerry, respect him very much, like him very much, but, you know, he is way, way off the mark on this one, catastrophically so, and I would think it would be well advised for his constituents to let him know what they think about that, too.
Actually, I don't know if you have a list of who was on the super committee, but if you do, I'd be interested to know who is on it.
Well, you know, I don't know it by heart. I know that...
Well, who are some?
I know that I should probably, but I know that John Kerry's on it. I know that Senator Patty Murray is on it. I know that Republican Jeb Hensarling is on it. But I don't know the entire list off the top of my
head.
People probably think of it as soon as I hang up.
Well, people will probably, you know, they can get in touch with their members of Congress. And I'll tell you.
Truly. I mean, that's the point. I mean, I think that you need to. You know, you say whoever your representative is,
yes,
you need to say to them, listen, I don't like this whole super committee thing. I don't want to be a part of it. Max Baucus is on it.
Yeah.
Clyburn, Becerra, who's right down the road from me, Chris Van Hollen, Dave Camp, Fred Upton, John Kyle, Pat Toomey, Rob Portman. So, you know, these, but whoever your, whoever your representative or senator is,
yes,
senator is also equally important, maybe more so, let them know, I don't like this process. If these guys come up with something like the Democrats have proposed, I expect you to vote against it.
RJ Esko, Richard, thank you very much for being with us. Very informative today, and hopefully people can take some action. Thank you for being with us again on the Burt Cohen Show.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right, and we'll see if people can come up and argue for some new values. Thanks very much for listening.
I'm healthy as a horse. Ah, but everything is spinning. And if I use a gun, I'm sure to go to prison. I'm stubborn as a mule, and nobody breaks my rules, but nothing comes my way. I got a hard-ass pair of shoulders. I got a love you can't imagine. Yeah, and what I got, I double. I swear I'm keeping out of trouble. I'm looking for one new value. I'm looking for one new value, but nothing comes my way. shopping comes my way.